Good evening and welcome to tonight's Commonwealth program with Project Runway's Tim Gunn. I'm Emily Payne, Project Runway contestant from season 13.
I'm Alexandria von Bromson, season 12.
And I am Richard Hallmark from season 11.
Well, you know the phrases.
I'm very concerned.
Or when you get your stuff. Thank you, mood.
And of course, make it work. Well, tonight's special guest is a man who helped us all make it work.
Tim Gunn is, of course, best known as co-host of the 12th time Emmy-nominated reality show Project Runway. He also hosted two seasons of his own Bravo makeover series, Tim Gunn's Guide to Style, and is the host of the reality TV show Under the Gun on Lifetime.
I'm shaking. I'm like... Tim began his fashion career as a teacher at Parsons, the New School of Design. And he's here tonight to talk about his life, career, and mentorship, the subject of his new book, The Natty Professor, a masterclass on mentoring, motivating, and making it work. Hello.
Tim will be in conversation with Brad Rosenstein, program producer at the Presidio Trust and former curator of exhibitions at the Museum of Performance and Design in San Francisco. Brad has also curated fashion-related exhibitions and events across the country, from the D. Young Museum to Lincoln Center. Please welcome Tim Gunn and Brad Rosenstein. Yay!
Francisco. Way to represent.
Brad,
we love our fashion icons, huh?
Can I say one thing to Alexandria and to Emily and to Richard? I know you introduced yourselves as contestants. I want you to know something. I never, ever, ever refer to you that way because to me, you are and always will be, well, extraordinary people, but designers. And whenever I'm asked by production to use the word contestant, I refuse because
Bravo.
It makes it sound like a game. And on the one hand, it is because someone's going to win. But it's very serious to me because this is about your lives. And I love and adore you all.
Yeah, bravo. Well, obviously, all of you here are no stranger to Tim Gunn. So you can imagine the abject panic with which I contemplated what the hell I was going to wear tonight.
Brad, you did a fine job, I have to say. I said to Brad backstage, I'm so impressed that a suit fits him. Most men I meet are wearing suits that are at least two sizes too big, or at least one size too big, usually two. I love the fact that this gentleman has a pocket square, and it doesn't match his tie, which is even better. So I give you an A.
Oh, my God. I can die now, right?
I give you a nattiness award. I've never given one until
God.
Today.
Well, I'd like to thank the Academy. It's an incredible honor. Well, it's great to have you all here, and it's great to have you
here.
Well,
I'm thrilled to be here, and I'm a huge fan of the Commonwealth Club, and it's rather surreal for me, and I couldn't be happier that we're having this conversation together, and I'm overwhelmed by the size of the crowd. So thank you, everyone. I hope you're still happy when this is all over.
Yeah. We'll do our best.
We
but
will.
Let's cut to the chase. What's Heidi Klum really like? Come on, it's just us. It's not going to leave this room.
Our designers will corroborate this. There isn't a diva's bone in her body. And all you need to know about Heidi is that every crew member loves her, and crew members do not suffer fools gladly. And she's a doll. She's an absolute doll. And as gorgeous as she is on camera, in print, she is breathtaking in person. She just is. And we're very lucky to have her.
Well, that's great.
She's our fearless leader.
Wonderful. No. And you heard it here first. Tim's wonderful new book, which is sitting right over there, is called The Natty Professor. And it's about mentorship and motivation and making it work. But what makes it incredible is that it's this very unique mix that I've never come across before of autobiography that's funny and moving and illuminating.
Well, thank you.
It's dish and gossip. As you would expect and hope for. But it's also, it's a very serious book about teaching. And I think for those of us who have admired you from the beginning on the show, I think one of the things we admired, even if we didn't know that you had 29 years in a classroom, is how phenomenal a teacher you are.
Well, thank you. I mean, not all my students agree, but I'm the tough love guy, and I'm the truth teller.
Yeah, well, that's what it's about. And so, you know, what this book is about is really a serious conversation. And you know, we talk so much in this country in the abstract about education.
Especially now.
Yeah, especially now. But what I love is that you've looking through the other end of the telescope at really the place where the rubber meets the road, the relationship between the teacher and the student.
Yes.
Which is where learning ultimately is going to happen. Why that focus and why this book now?
Well, for me, any successful... I'm trying to think of how to phrase this. Any success that we have moving the needle forward is the result of a collaboration. I don't believe we do anything alone. And teaching and mentoring is just that. It's not, speaking for myself, it's not me laying down rules and regulations and saying thou shalt and thou shall not. It's really about each individual. What is that individual trying to achieve? How can I support that? How can I help enhance it? And how can I help the individual move that needle forward as well? So the relationship is critical. It's why I'm going to get myself in trouble here, but that's all right. You know me.
Yeah,
I tell the truth.
We're friends.
I mean, I have a lot of reservations about online classes because, well, first of all, I haven't experienced it, so maybe there is a relationship there, I don't know. But for me, as a student, that relationship with the teacher, and in some cases a mentor, was all important for me. If you're thinking about reading things online, even a text message, there's no intonation. So there's
no
so many ways.
Voice.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's so many different ways you could actually hear those words spoken. And for me, it's the subtlety, the nuance, it's the phrasing, it's the tilt of the head. There's so much that goes into a lesson and into a relationship.
There's so much that you're talking about that's very specific and I would think extremely helpful to teachers and just some very basic but fundamental things that could be very useful in a classroom, like cultivating your sense of curiosity.
Yes.
Asking questions instead of giving the answers. And yet, as I'm reading it, I'm thinking, who doesn't this apply to? Who, you know, it's part of all of our life lessons.
No matter what
really.
We do.
Yeah.
Exactly. So when people say, well, this is a book for teachers, well, in our own way, isn't each of us a teacher and each of us a student? I certainly believe I am, even though I'm not running a classroom.
Yeah.
Just having to do with, as you say, curiosity.
Absolutely. And, you know, your catchphrase, make it work, has appeared in the subtitles of a couple of the books. It's obviously your most famous catchphrase from Project Runway, but it far predates all of that.
Oh.
And what I came to understand in reading this and reading your other books is how fundamental it is to your understanding of your life, your career, how you embrace the world. Can you talk about how it evolved and why it's important?
Well, I certainly remember when I first used the phrase. The classes that I've taught and for 29, well, not for 29 years, but for 23 of 29 years, I was a 3D, three-dimensional design instructor to students across many disciplines. And it's a product-oriented class, so students are making things. And I found quickly that there is an inclination to abandon a project that's not going well, something that when you think, oh, this isn't working, I'm going to start all over again. I used to not only condone it, I used to support it. Okay, start all over again, providing there's enough time. But I was teaching classes that ran 15 weeks. It's not like Project Runway where it's 15 minutes, just about.
Real world.
Really. Yeah. So I then thought, I'm doing my students a disservice. This abandoning of a problem at hand is not good for them. If they sit with it, offer up a diagnosis of what's going wrong, and then figure out a prescription for how to make it work, they have a whole new set of resources to go into their problem-solving arsenal. And I just firmly believe in it. And if it's such a dire situation that you really can't make it work, well, then let's talk about it together and about what to do and where to go forward, how to go forward. But it goes back to my own education as an art and design student, and the things that I learned when I was so eager and quick to abandon something and move on, and I learned quickly. Just a brief anecdote. I'm not a natural whiz at drawing. It's a struggle. I'd studied architecture, and it's very technical, and I like that. I like a straight edge and a French curve, and you can just follow the lines. When it comes to freehand drawing, I'm really quite clumsy and klutzy by nature. But as a first-year art student, I had two incredible teachers. I dedicate the book to them, Rona Slade and William Christenberry. And Rona is this very tough-minded, tough-love woman from Wales. Huh. And I was struggling with the still life. And there were 30 students in the class, and the school was across the street from a park. And Rona came over and stood behind me and made me even more nervous than I already was. And she said to me, "Stop. Stop. Stop." "Okay." She said, "I want you to go across the street to the park and find the largest stick that you possibly can." I thought, oh my God, what's she going to do with this?
Tough love. Tough love.
So I was very conscious of this when editing through these various limbs that were spread around. Thinking, well, I want it to be substantial enough that it looks as though I took this charge seriously, but I don't want it to be so substantial that it's going to hurt.
All so, valid considerations.
Exactly. So when I came back to the studio, at my place, she had moved the table away, and there was a huge piece of photo backdrop paper, which is roughly 10 feet in width, and it can be as long as you want it to be. So it was about 10 feet by about 15 feet, and she had filled a bowl with India ink. And she said to me, "I want you to use the stick and draw the still life." Huh. Because she wanted me to loosen up. I had been so tight and tense, and not only was I going to be using my whole arm in a gestural way, I was going to be using my whole body. I'll never forget that moment, ever. And it was one of the best drawings I ever did.
So that's great teaching.
It's a make it work moment.
Yeah, definitely.
Yes.
I'm fascinated by the fact that you started out as a sculptor. What was your work like?
It's interesting. I'll segue back to architecture for just a moment because I spent most of my childhood wanting to be an architect. I loved Legos. And I have to tell you, I'm so old. I go back to the days before there was a prescription for Lego. They were just anonymous blocks in a box. In fact, I remember when Windows came out, I was rhapsodic because I've been making them. I was just leaving little holes, and I put cardboard shutters on the outside. And suddenly, there it all is for you. So, in fact, my mother would tell the story about visiting Monticello, Jefferson's home in Charlottesville, Virginia. And I was a nine-year-old kid, and I used all my allowance money to buy Thomas Jefferson's architectural drawings. And she thought, well, on the one hand, this is rather nice. On the other hand, it's really strange. And I still have the book. At any rate.
Oh, tell the soap story, too.
Oh. Try to remember what year it was in elementary school, but it was elementary school. And it must have been fairly early, but not too early that we could have hurt ourselves. So... We were each to bring in a bar of soap, and I chose Ivory because it's big and bulky and rectangular, not like some other soaps. And we were to make something with this bar of soap, and my classmates were making, ducks and little pigs and barnyard animals for the most part, because they're amorphous and you can just put a little nose on and carve out an eye. I am proud to say that I carved the governor's palace in Williamsburg. And I did.
I'd say the handwriting was on the wall at that point, quite literally.
So, my architecture story. So, I studied architecture for one semester, hated it. Really hated it. I thought I'm going to be doing plumbing and wiring specs for gas stations the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be Frank Lloyd Wright or Thomas Jefferson. It wasn't going to happen. So my sculpture ended up being, let me also say on the top of Make It Work, I've been through so many phases of my life where I've been in a state of apologia, and it was true when I was studying sculpture. There are these people around me welding and hammering away at marble and casting plaster things, and I was working with paper, an illustration board, building work that was architectural in terms of references and association, but I wasn't making buildings. And people were constantly asking, what is that? In fact, at the end of my junior year, there was a big critique, and there were a lot of very well-known Washington artists who were there. It was the era of the Washington Color School. And I'll never forget, the Simon & Schuster, Gallery Books is part of Simon & Schuster, the Simon & Schuster legal team told me not to use his name in the book, but I'll tell you his name because you don't know who he is anyway. This artist by the name of Leon Berkowitz was overseeing this final critique. And he actually looked at me, and I had 12 sculptures on pedestals in this section of this large room. And he looked at me and he said, I'll never forget it. I would rather look at the space this work displaces than look at the work itself. I mean, where do you go from there?
Retirement.
Well, and I have to tell you, on the topic of truth-telling, I only believe in talking about things you can change. And that was my body of work at that moment. It wasn't going anywhere. And that was the end of the critique. I'd rather look at the space the work displaces. Well, have at it, Mr. Berkowitz.
Thank you, Mr. Berkowitz.
Yes, exactly. But, you know, I also say it's very interesting, and this is at least from my own experience, and you all can either refute it or corroborate it. Who do we remember as teachers? The really fantastic great ones and the really horrible bitchy ones.
Yeah.
And everyone in between, they're just sort of like pablum. And it's just the sea of, I don't remember that person.
Yeah, the top and the bottom.
Yeah, exactly.
Definitely. But your early schooling was a pretty horrendous experience for you.
I mean, the irony about my becoming a career educator is that I absolutely detested school. I loved learning, loved it. I was an insatiable reader. I had nothing if not a curious mind. But I hated the social aspects of school.
Why?
There were a number of things. I knew I was an odd kid. I had a terrible, debilitating stutter, which instantly was like I was this Pariah. Beacon for every possible dimension of teasing. Hey, say Mississippi, Tim, and it would be ugh. Yeah. It was awful. I mean, it was really a horrendous experience. I was sick as often as I possibly could be. I ran away from home, but usually in my home. And if you decide to do that, don't have a hunting dog like a basset hound. Because they know how to find you.
You're outed immediately.
So then I started to run away to Rock Creek Park. I grew up in Washington. To places I knew in the park, and then my mother would send Brandy, the basset hound, out to get me, and she'd find me in minutes. But then I started to take her with me. But the trouble was I never had enough water and snacks to satisfy her, so she got very restless and wanted to go home.
Thwarted.
But we were a good couple, Brandy and I.
Yeah. But, you know, this is a story that unfortunately we're becoming all too familiar with now, and what the consequences of that kind of bullying and treatment happen to people. And it happened to you.
And it did, Brad. And I don't want to sit here and sound like boo-hoo, poor me. But the topic here is teaching. I fundamentally do not recall a teacher ever conducting any sort of interference in this, ever. And it strikes me that if it were I, and it was happening to one of my students, I'd definitely, I mean, if only to take me aside and ask, how does this make you feel? Are there some resources we can bring to this? It never once happened. And I did, I mean, one of my worst memories as an elementary school student was in the sixth grade, Mr. Allison, may you rest in peace if you're not already, who saw this shy, withdrawn, I wasn't that I was unsocialized, I was just antisocial. This antisocial kid would sit alone in the cafeteria and, you know, hated the whole playground scene, all that. He handed me an eraser, a chalkboard eraser, and said, I want you to throw it across the room. And I flew into this panic. Saying to myself, I can't throw this across the room. And he kept repeating, throw it. And with each successive repetition, he'd get louder. Throw it, throw it. And suddenly I felt he was the enemy too. And I bolted from the room. Oh my. At any rate.
Yeah.
Boo-hoo.
Yeah.
I'm going to say, oh, cry me a river, Tim.
Yeah.
At any rate, we all go through these things, but it's so, as I say, life's a big collaboration. I didn't feel it was at that time. I felt very, very much alone. You know, the other thing, my big macho father, and we didn't have the greatest relationship. He was a career FBI agent, 26 years. You know, my father never once took me aside and said, I'm going to show you how to defend yourself. You're getting beaten up in the playground. Let me show you how to pull off and smack someone.
Right.
And the consequence is...
Thank goodness you finally learned.
No. The consequence is I am the best hair puller and biter. I am. I really am. So if you tangle with me, I hope you've had your tetanus shots.
Again, I mean, not to indulge in a mawkish side of this, but I mean, this took you very far. You wound up attempting suicide very seriously at 17.
Yeah.
And you wound up spending 2 years in a psychiatric hospital.
2 years and 3 months.
But in a way, that was also a way out, because you found a therapist who in many ways was the best kind of teacher.
He saved my life. Yeah.
How?
Well, I was in this, what I came to realize was a really extraordinary facility, and was, of course, miserable. I don't want to dwell on the mawkishness at all, but I will say this. When I took this very big overdose of pills and went to bed, that was, I was feeling ethereal. I was feeling delivered from all of this awfulness. It was one of the most euphoric experiences I've ever had. And it wasn't the drug aspect, trust me. It was just peace of mind. And then waking up the next morning and having this horrible ringing in my ears and very blurry vision and thinking, oh my God, well, I'm not dead, but I've probably done myself in, and I have, anyway, I'm here, so I didn't do myself in. But I ended up being hospitalized, and my first psychiatrist there was, you're going to love this name, you can't make this stuff up, his name was Dr. Blank. How much more neutral does it get than that?
It's right out of a Warner Brothers cartoon.
I know. You know? So Dr. Blank would say to me, when I would be in my own way pouring my soul out to him, he sat there with this great big, with this pipe, and he'd say, who cares? So what? Why should I care? Gee.
Thank you, doctor.
You're so warm and fuzzy.
The hour is up.
So, yeah. So I, Dr. Blank gave up. I had another doctor, Dr. Schimmelbusch, there's a name for you too, who was, well, the point of all this is to say, I decided I'm just going to be an immovable force, and I will be so resistant to any attempt to help me that they'll discharge me. So I just stopped talking during these therapy sessions, and Dr. Schimmelbusch would say after 20 minutes, well, if you're not going to say anything, we're not continuing. Good day. And I thought, okay, good. This is good. This is going my way.
It's working.
Yeah. Right. And we had group therapy many times during the week. I would say nothing. Nothing. And it wasn't hard for me. I mean, I still had this terrible stutter. I still was antisocial. I wasn't interested in getting to know anyone. So then this... I didn't know how extraordinary he was, but this kid came, Dr. Philip Goldblatt. He was right out of his residency. So he was young, and he was newly appointed to me. I think I was considered this incurable of sorts, and Dr. Goldblatt decided to take me on. And I was used to leaving these sessions after 20 minutes. No, we would just sit there. And he
waited you out.
He waited me out, and he wouldn't be distracted by papers. I mean, God knows it was before all this technology. So he would just sit there, and sit there with me. It wasn't staring at me; just sit there with me. And in the beginning, I said, "Well, we've been sitting here for I don't know how long, but I'm not going to say anything." And he said, "That's okay. Don't say anything. We'll just sit here." So then he said, because normally therapy was 5 days a week, he said, I want to see you 5 days, or 3 days a week. I want to see you 5 days a week. 5 days a week? Of all the sitting around? So...
He had your number.
But he broke me. I mean, eventually, he did. He broke me. I just want to say one other thing about those many months having to do with how profoundly our society and culture has changed, not everyone has, when it comes to issues, well, when it comes to LGBT issues. There was a young man there, and the psychiatric facility was really for adolescents and young adults, so it was very targeted to a certain demographic. And there was a young man there who was so desperately unhappy and sad and cried all the time and wanted to see his mother and this person he referred to as his friend. Well, he was gay. Only in those days they called it, he was homosexual. And in those days, and this is late 60s, early 70s-ish, it was considered, homosexuality was considered something, an illness that should be fixed. So at that particular time regarding my own sexuality, I certainly didn't know who I was, but I knew who I wasn't. And what I wasn't was heterosexual. But I thought, I can't even tap into these feelings in me, into this part of me, because I don't want to become like him. I mean, I thought, I have enough issues without welcoming that.
I got enough problems already.
Yeah, exactly. But it's interesting to reflect upon that and realize how much we have changed. And do I believe that that John's time in the hospital cured him? Of course not.
Right.
It's not, no, of course not.
Were you consciously dealing with your gay identity at that time? Was that part of what you were
working through?
I called myself
asexual or non-sexual. Yeah, but I would look at John, and he was someone who could be lovely and someone I actually could enjoy talking to, and I think, no, this cannot happen. This cannot. So I just suppressed everything as far inside me as I possibly could. I don't even know why I told that story, but at any rate.
Yeah.
It's an indicator of how much we have changed.
The times. Yeah. The times. I want to leap ahead.
To
Project Runway. but everything we've been talking about is relevant because we're talking about truth-telling, we're talking about honesty, which is, I think, what helped you to a large degree. And I think what we see with you now in the workroom critique is embodying a lot of that with your designers. And one of the points you make in the book is that it's a really watershed exchange that happens with you and the designers at that time. Because first it's the designer learning to really hear and accept the critique and not shut down. But it's also work on the teacher's part to not impose their ego, do the work for them.
And I have to say, as the designers here know, the first thing that I do when I approach their workspace is ask them, talk to me. Tell me what you're doing. Tell me what you're trying to achieve here. Because I need as much information as I can possibly have in order to channel what they are doing. And get under their, or get into their skin, not under their skin, hopefully, but get into their, I get under the skin of some of them,
that's
for sure.
That's macabre, but
But get into their skin and as I said, try to channel who they are and help them be the best at that. And also, structure of the new book, The Natty Professor, according to the word teach, which I turned into an acronym. T is for truth-telling, E is for empathy, A is for asking, which is what we're just talking about, C is for cheerleading, and I love H. H is hoping for the best, meaning let it go. But the E, empathy, that's another aspect of it, where I, my pregnant pauses, which are cleaned up in the edit of the show, because as the designers know, I'm in there for a long time, not mere nanoseconds. I'm not this stealth instrument that comes in and says, X, Y, and Z, and I get out. I'm frequently...
The stealth gun. I like it.
When I'm standing there with that, my chin on my hand and I'm pondering, I'm also, what I'm doing is I'm running through my head what I want to say to the designer. So I'm listening to the words and to the intonation, going back to a text that doesn't give you that advantage. I'm listening to the words and the intonation, asking myself, how would I respond to this? Would I flee? Would I think I'm trying to help? Would I, how would I respond? And then I make amendments accordingly. So I believe empathy is such an important quality in teachers. But I have to tell you something. I learned something recently from a psychologist. There are two categories of people who cannot possess empathy. And I found this fascinating and explains a lot. And the categories are narcissists and sociopaths. And I work with a lot of them. Not here, but in teaching and in entertainment, they're a lot. So but, they can't possess empathy. How awful is that?
Yeah, exactly. Well, but if you look back over all these seasons now of doing Project Runway, is there a moment when you had that kind of encounter with a designer who really, really tested you at the time and you thought, this is hopeless, but by the end you got to a place where you both had gotten something positive out of the experience?
No. I have to tell you, those negative experiences just kept continuing. And I think it's a personality type. And I have to tell you, there is a point that I would reach in my teaching years and on Project Runway. It happens infrequently. In fact, the last time I can remember it happening, even in a remotely egregious way, I think it was it season five? Kenley.
Wait.
Do you remember
you
her?
You all know Kenley, right?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Unfixable. It reaches a point where you have to say either to yourself or out loud to the individual, I can't want you to succeed more than you do. So why do I feel more invested in your success than you do? So, fine. I mean, I would tell Kenley in the workroom, because I would go over to her table and she would audibly groan. She'd go, ugh. Look, I have a responsibility to you to give you equal time, and I'm going to. You can just keep working while I'm talking. You don't have to answer any of my questions. Just do what you're doing. But there was one divine moment. I'm trying to remember who our guest judge was. The designers had to pull from our button bag or something or other a music genre. And Kenley chose, and they had to design for it, and Kenley chose hip-hop. And I'm looking at these skinny jeans, before skinny jeans were even so as pervasive as they are now, and this little tube top. And I'm asking her, I need your help. I need help understanding what this has to do with hip-hop. What is your interpretation of this? And she gave me that all, oh, you old grandpa, what would you know? And I'm the hip kid on the block, and you're just an old fart. All right. So we had, I wish I could remember who it was, some 20-something, LL Cool J, thank you. That's exactly okay. Who it was. There's someone here with an encyclopedic Project Runway mind. Thank you.
Never lose that.
So LL Cool J called her out on the skinny jeans. I loved it. Loved it.
Take that, Grandpa.
Yeah. It's like, And I didn't have any interaction with him. I didn't prep him. Yeah. Anyway. But, I mean, I make it a personal challenge to do all that I can to work with each of the designers
sure.
on the show. I mean, I believe in them. I really believe that when we get down to our 16 designers who are there fresh and new, that any one of them can win. You never know, though, how each designer will respond to the circumstances. And we have three designers here who can all testify to the fact that it's really grueling. I mean, it is.
We were just talking before the
incredibly difficult and daunting. And as Emily knows from experience, which is not to say that Richard and Alexandria don't know, but the structure of the show has changed since they were on the show. As Emily knows, I now have, well, as anyone who's seen the last two seasons of the show knows, I now have this wonderful moment that I was not at all happy about. I didn't want to do it, but the producers said, look, we want you to present the models wearing the top three and the bottom three looks to the judges. It's your moment to have some time before them and to have a say if you want to. And I was really resisting it because I had for so many reasons said that the relationship that I have with the judges is one of the separation of church and state. I don't interact. I usually say hello when they arrive. I usually don't say goodbye because I'm mad. So suddenly I had this...
Tim has been known to refer to them as crack smoking judges.
Oh, yes. Yeah. With a good deal of... They don't disappoint when it comes to that. So I then had this... Why am I going off on this story about presenting to the judges? Oh, I know why. Because
you had to sit in one time.
Well,
too,
that was that was a whole other thing. I'll never do that again. Yeah. But having this moment before them, when they start rolling their eyes and they're looking at, they flip a hem over and they're looking at the stitching and they're looking at one another like, I step in like a stealth weapon and I say, listen, sisters, 10 hours. 10 hours to conceive, to shop, to drape, to draft, to cut, sew, to fit the model, to style the model, and get it out here on the runway. They have 10 hours. You do it. No, guys, I'm in awe of you. I am in awe. Complete and total awe. Yeah.
Fabulous. Do you have a sense, I mean, after all these years, all the awards, all the acclaim, but this is not how the show started out. I mean, it was very reviled by the industry.
It was.
When you began.
We were almost canceled.
Yeah.
No one was watching us. The industry was polarized. I will say, designers loved the show from the beginning because they could say to their families, watch this show, you'll have a much better understanding of what it is that I do. And whenever anyone said, and there was and still is criticism, oh, this isn't even remotely like the real industry, Michael Kors was always the first one to leap up and say, wait a minute, I, just this past season of Fashion Week, I had 48 looks I was showing, 12 of them were knits that never got off the boat from China. Wow. So it's the night before the show. I can't suddenly get rid of 12 looks. I have a make it work moment. So this does happen all the time. And I mean, Project Runway is really a version of what in architecture school is called a charrette. You get an assignment, you all know, yes. So you get an assignment on a Friday night and you have to show it on a Sunday, but even that is a luxury of time. It's so funny, my teaching and Project Runway overlapped for 4.5 seasons. And I used to be, I was never a pushover, but I was a sympathetic ear to my students in their 15-week semester, to my students, speaking up about deadlines. Once I had the Project Runway experience, it's like, what are you talking about? You have a week. I mean, I know you have other things on your plate, but you have a week. So cry me a river.
Do you have a sense, now that it's found the audience that it has, why this show connects so strongly and continues to connect with
Well, first of all, I have always been a... Well, I shouldn't say have always been. I am reminded regularly that television viewers are smart. Not all of them. If you're watching Duck Dynasty, you have a problem. But the viewer for our show is smart. In fact, at one point, the largest per capita demographic for us was Seattle, and people would ask, don't you think that's surprising? It's not exactly a fashionable city. And I said, no, I'm not surprised, because I think it's probably also a city that has a very high level of education, and I believe we attract a smart viewer. And I believe people really are enamored of the whole creative process. But I have to tell you a story that was just devastating at the time. Season one, no one knew what we were doing, and we were still doing it. We were taping it. And I was standing in the Parsons Auditorium watching the Q&A between the judges and the designers, and there was a woman standing next to me, and I didn't know who she was. And unless she had seen tapes of the show, she wouldn't have known who I was, and she didn't indicate that she knew who I was. So we were two strangers watching this activity. And she turned to me and she asked, who's going to want to watch this? And I said to her, you're corroborating my worst fear. And then I shared the story with one of the producers, and I asked, who was that person? And they said, oh, that's Lauren Zelaznik, the president of Bravo. That we started. I said, great. The president of the network. I flew into a quasi-panic about, well, if the president of Bravo is looking at this thinking, who wants to watch this, then what are we going to see? The sexual escapades that possibly are happening in the apartments at night? Yeah. And I was really worried about it. So I also...
Because you had invested a lot of yourself.
Well, I have to also tell you, Brad, I was completely confident that I would not be in the cut of the show. I thought, as long as they have the designers responding to me, no one needs to see me, no one needs to hear my voice. And that combined with sexual escapades...
You were happy to be off camera.
Well, I was very ambivalent. I had mixed feelings. So I did not go to the premiere party. I thought, well, if I'm in the show, how will all this appear and what will it be? And if I'm not in the show, I'll feel totally humiliated. So I watched the first episode the way I used to watch The Wizard of Oz as a kid. I was under the covers of my bed like this, and I'd peek out, and I put it back up, and I'd peek out. I thought, this is a really good show. But it's true. No one was watching. And I was going off on the... We premiered right around Thanksgiving. And we were showing at February Fashion Week, and I was on the first home visits. I thought they would be the last home visits. And I'm in a production van going to from New York to Pennsylvania to visit Jay McCarroll, and then from Pennsylvania to Virginia to visit Wendy Pepper. And we have a horrible snowstorm. And Jane Lipsitz, one of the original executive producer, is in the passenger seat. I'm behind her. She's on her cell phone, and it's something incredibly tense and awkward. Well, she's talking to the network, and the ratings are terrible, and they're talking about canceling the show. And I can hear this. So when Jane hung up, I said, you know, it's quiet because of all the snowfall, and we're the only vehicle on the road. So I heard most of that. Can we just turn around and go back to New York? Why are we risking life and limb? And then we stuck like a pot sticker on the wall. And the ratings started climbing, and...
The rest is history.
I never dreamed we'd have a season two. But also on the topic of polarizing, it was. I have a dear friend at the Council of Fashion Designers of America who's been there forever, and she hated the show. And I've never figured out why, and I frankly don't care to talk to her about it, unless we're right here. Lisa, tell us why you hate the show so much.
Before all these people.
So we were, I remember this vividly, it was... Bastille Day, it was July 14th, 2005. We had just wrapped season two. And that same day, we were nominated for an Emmy for season one. And I'll never forget that. Thank you. I'll never forget that moment ever. It was electrifying. So I was leaving Parsons, the CFDA is directly across the street, and I was walking home, and I run into Lisa. And she says to me, that it's that evening, she says to me, oh, I understand that you're taping that show again. And I still remember looking at her saying, that show was just nominated for an Emmy.
Wonderful. We're going to, in just a couple of minutes, we're going to invite you all up to ask questions at the microphones. And so be formulating questions. As we said at the top, please, no long statements, no introductions, no five-part questions.
In other words, don't ask questions the way I respond to them.
Right, exactly. We'll be here all night. So we'll start that in just a minute. But while we're gearing up for that, we're not letting you out of here without some dish.
Oh, okay.
So,
what dish would you like, Brad?
Well,
I've got a whole buffet spread
out. I know. And I'm going right for desserts. you're very eloquent on the subject of extensive misbehavior in the fashion industry.
I see lots of it, and I have no tolerance for it.
And your poster child for this would be Miss Anna Wintour.
Poor thing, can't help herself.
I love your description of her in one of the books. She is a sphinx without a question.
She is.
Which puts it all in a nutshell. But lay it on us. What's your best Anna story?
Oh, boy. Well, I'll tell you the shortest, and then I can tell you the best. The shortest happened fairly recently. I was on a plane going from New York to Los Angeles. A flight attendant came over to me, and she said, "We're so happy to have you on board. It's so nice to see you." And of course, I'm delighted. Thank you. I'm happy to meet you, and thrilled to be here. She said, "I think that's Anna Wintour on the other over there." And I looked, and I thought, "Oh my God, yes, it is." So she said, "Do you think I could say hello to her?" I said, "Well, of course you can say hello to her." And I meant that sincerely. So Anna's sitting next to the window, and there's a person in the seat next to her, and she's reading. And I'm looking at this with my peripheral vision. I dare not catch her eye because she could turn me to stone. So The flight attendant goes over, and she leans forward to speak, and I see Anna's right hand. It comes up about 6 inches like this. And the man seated on the aisle rises and says to the flight attendant, "Miss, you'll have to go away." I thought, she can't say hello? That's the short story. I won't tell the long, long, long story because it goes on and on and on. But I was asked by the New York Post, what is the one thing you've seen in fashion that you'll never forget? The one thing you've seen in fashion that you'll never forget. And I said without hesitating, oh, that's easy. It was watching Anna Wintour being carried down 5 flights of stairs from a fashion show. Period. Just the facts, ma'am. And that's what they printed. That was on a Sunday. It was the TV Guide issue. On Monday, I'm teaching. I come back to my office at noon, and there's a message that Miss Wintour has called. Well, I know she didn't call, but somebody did. And to call back. And I thought, oh, for God's sake. So I thought, when will she be at lunch? And I thought, I have to channel her. When will she be having her raw meat? And I thought, probably 2:30 is a good time to call. I called and she wasn't in. The person who then took the call was a gentleman by the name of Patrick O'Connell, who I still feel terrible for, who was her VP of communications. So Patrick tells me that Miss Wintour demands that I retract the story and instruct the Post to retract it. And I said, retract the story? That would imply that it's not true. Well, it's not true. I said, well, it is true. And I keep all of my date books, thankfully. Keep them. If you're inclined to throw them away, don't. Anna Wintour may call you. So I said, look, it was September.
Should be on the cover of every diary, right?
I said, it was September such and such, noon, Peter Somm show, the Metropolitan Pavilion on 18th Street, fifth floor. And with each declaration of mine, he'd say, oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear. So I had the facts. And what's so interesting is I was there with some colleagues from Parsons. We remarked. I mean, we knew, and Peter Somm's an alum of Parsons, so he's near and dear to us. And we knew that Anna's a big fan, and we knew she'd be at the show because she's a huge supporter of Peter's. So we knew the venue. And there's one freight elevator, and Miss Wintour does not ride in an elevator with mere mortals. So we weren't concerned about how she was going to ascend. That's easy. The bodyguards block out everyone. She gets in, and up she goes. But we were wondering, how's she going to get out of here? Because everyone's going to rush out at the same time. Sure. And we thought, this is going to be very interesting to watch. So we had standing room, we were near the door, and we had a prime view of everything. So there were two bodyguards on each side of her, seated, and when the show was over, the three of them suddenly disappeared, and we watched as the bodyguards made a fireman's lock. She sat in it, and they whisked her down this big open industrial staircase. So I went to the railing with my colleagues and looked. And then, as we're seeing this descent down, it was very Hitchcockian. We're seeing this.
Vertigo.
I decide to rush to the window because I want to know what they're going to do when they reach the sidewalk. Will they put her down or take her that way to the car? They took her that way to the car. They did. So the next day, this is now Tuesday, I get another call from Patrick O'Connell. And you're going to love this. Talk about a declaration. Hello, Patrick. He says, I want you to know Miss Wintour knows how to work a Manolo. What? She knows how to work a Manolo. She could have taken the stairs. I said, this wasn't an issue of whether she had the agility of working a high heel. It had to do with speed. Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Oh, dear. So Wednesday he calls and he says, well, we have to get the lawyers involved. And I said, thank goodness, because it means if the lawyers are involved, I can't speak to you. So this will all be over. So then a colleague of mine came in for a meeting and he looked at me and he said, what's the matter with you? You look horrible. And I said, I am horrible. I'm being tormented. And I told him the story. He said, I was there. I saw it too. He got on the phone, called Patrick O'Connell, and he said, I'm corroborating Tim's story. I was there too. I mean, there were probably 60 people who saw it in that vestibule. I mean, we were all wrapped, but I was the only one who had, I don't know, the stupidity, the naivete to actually call her out on it. So then I decided after it was all over to take the high road. I love taking the high road. I called my florist. I sent him a handwritten note for Miss Wintour, never apologizing. Well, that's not true. I said that I regretted that this blurb in the Post, I don't think I used the word blurb, caused you such distress, most sincerely. So this arrangement, because I saw it was beautiful, was all white. And of course, in Western culture, white is the symbol of peace, but in Asian cultures, it means death.
Death. And you were in an Eastern kind of mood that day.
I thought, let's let this be ambiguous.
No. Black, white.
And my message here is, I didn't annihilate her character. I mean, I am now. Well, I'm not annihilating it. It's just the facts. And the Post didn't go after her like this crazy, wacky person. It just said, that's the most unforgettable thing I've ever seen in fashion. And that was the reaction. How much time must she have on her hands?
Indeed.
But there really is, there is a tremendous fear of her. And, oh, and then people have said to me about Guns, Golden Rules, it's going to happen with the Natty Professor, too. Aren't you afraid people will never ask you to anything? Yeah. Don't ask me.
Your calendar just got free.
I couldn't be happier.
We may have to return to this topic, but do we have people for questions?
Are people afraid of me? I hope not.
Over there? Oh, there we go.
Hi.
Hi.
How stunning you look.
I'm gigantic, and this mic is quite low.
How gigantic are you?
I'm 5'9", but I'm cheating today, and I'm about 6 foot or so.
You're still shorter than Heidi. Use that as consolation.
Well, maybe I'll grow. Anyway, I'm Elizabeth.
And hi, Elizabeth.
I'm a huge fan of the show, so thank you for being here. One of my favorite parts of the show is really watching you interact with the designers, and particularly when things get really emotional. Your Tim Gunn save, when the designer cries, when you cry, then I cry. And I'm just wondering what has been the most special, the most touching moment over all the years of Project Runway?
Oh, well, I mean, when it comes to the Tim Gunn save, since there only have been two, I won't reflect upon that. But though I will say the first one, Justin LeBlanc, I mean, all the camera and audio people were crying. And it had to be done. It just had to be. You know, for me, there's a lot of emotion you don't see. And what always just captivates me and keeps me aligned with the designers and propels me forward is the extraordinary opportunity that I have to bear witness to a designer having an epiphany about what they can achieve. It's the most thrilling and satisfying thing in the world. I mean, to watch that happen, and it happened for all of you. I mean, I saw it, and it's just, and it's only one of many, and I'm sure it wasn't the first for any of you either, but to be there and see it happen and see that aha recognition in your eyes, it's extraordinary for me and very emotional.
Would you please comment on who you think controls the size of the models?
designers. Oh. The French are talking about legislating against anorexic models at this point.
They should. I mean, I have to tell you, on the topic of our models, they're otherworldly. They're not built... Well, Alexandria, you're an exception, but used to be a model. So they're not the size, shape, and proportions of most people in this world. I have been advocating with Lifetime, we've been on Lifetime now for 8 seasons, to have an entire season where the models are size 12 and larger. I think it would be fantastic. And don't you think? I don't know why people don't want to listen to me. I mean, I think it would be fantastic. And for the designers on the show, they'll have a whole season of experience with real women, because that's what they're real women. And they'll understand how anyone can look great, regardless of size and shape. It's about silhouette, proportion, and fit, and respecting that individual.
Well, and I think that's been one of the vital things about the show, is that it's about real clothes for real people.
Well, it should
much
be.
Much more than the wild fantasy.
But I have
to tell you, where is that going
to
go?
Speaking of the crack-smoking judges, I've never gotten over this. It was season 3. We had our first real woman challenge, where we had women who are Well, and that's actually not the word I was searching for. Who are, I can't think of it. But at any rate, they're not professional models. So they're coming in. It was the mother's challenge. That's what it was. So we have the designer's mothers and, in a couple of cases, sisters. And we made an assumption that they would be size 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, whatever, that they would not be a size 00. So the designers create work for these beautiful individuals, and the work is really good. Mm. Who do the judges give the prize to? To the designer who created the work for Uli, who was a designer on the show, Uli's mother, who was like this, who was probably a size 2 in the company of all these other women who were just simply were a larger size. I thought, what's wrong with you people? This is exactly what we weren't supposed to do. And that wasn't the... Anyway, it gets me crazy. It gets me crazy.
Smoke and crack. Yeah.
Everyone's so well-dressed.
Hi, Tim. Thank you for being here in San Francisco.
Thank you for being here.
Lots of people waiting, so I'm going to get straight to my question. I love your compassion on the show, by the way. It's fantastic. But what do you think of the wearables market? I mean, we're here in Silicon Valley. This is a confluence of fashion and technology. People have mixed feelings about it, and I'd love to know what your thoughts are.
Tell me, what's your name?
It's Andrea.
Andrea, tell me what you mean by wearables. You mean wearable technology?
So the Internet of Things, right? So anything can be, you know, tracked devices. So the most sort of prevalent wearable these days are things like fitness devices. So watches, you can put a wearable on your shoe. They're building technology into clothing now. So for a long time, astronauts have had things to measure temperature and pressure and all these things. And now the wearables market, because of the Internet of Things, it's a term, is coming into fashion.
You know, I have to tell you, I said earlier that I believe the television viewer is smart, or certainly can be. I trust the consumer, and if the consumer has a fervor for this and is attracted to it, and it sticks, if it actually stays and it sustains itself, I'll be very interested in knowing what happens. I wouldn't dream of saying, I think it's great, or I don't think it's terrible. How great it is, I really do, I defer to the consumer on it. There's another example having to do with sustainability and green and sustainable textiles. At the moment, they're so limited. They don't take dyes well. It's just, as a fashion designer, it would be extremely limiting to have to work with those textiles. I believe they will evolve as non-woven textiles have. I remember my first experience with a non-woven at Parsons. It was probably the year 2000, 2001, and I thought, well, it looks all right, but it feels like a paper towel. I mean, the touch of it was awful. And now, nonwovens have evolved considerably, and people are wearing them. So we'll see where it takes us. I'm certainly interested in it. It's important.
Great.
This is Caroline, by the way. I love her.
She's keeping us wonderful on producer.
Point.
Hi, Tim.
Hi.
You mentioned your own experience with bullying in your past. Can you tell me, have there been a lot of behind-the-scenes bullying going on? I know that there's a lot of commentary from the designers making negative comments about other designers in that they're competing with. Has the crew ever had to get involved with some bullying? Because it seems like a lot of it, with their commentary, it happens. But I'm just wondering if it's ever gotten to the point where it's gotten...
Well, I get involved. I mean, when I'm aware of it, I get very involved. I'll give you an example from season 13, which Emily knows only too well. There was a whole new thing happening, and it was asking each designer who's going home and who's going to win. And it happened on camera. And I thought, well, first of all, who really cares? Because the designers aren't making the decision. I thought it puts the designers in an awkward position. But what I didn't know was that they were going to tell the designer that everyone thought was going home, they were going to tell them, oh, everyone thought you were going to go home. And that designer, of course, it was Sandhya, first episode of season 13, and I mean, she won the challenge, which is ironic, but that's a whole other matter having to do with severe crack smoking. So she won the challenge, and then they tell her, by the way, all the other designers thought you should go home for that. And how about the mentor? I thought she should have, too. But I would never have said that to her. It's truth that you can't do anything about. And it was horrible. So there was this, and then the next challenge was a team challenge. And she felt picked upon. It was awful. At any rate, I went into the production room and I said, this has got to stop. Well, John Murray of Buna Murray loves it. Well, I don't. And I think it's cruel, and there's enough. I mean, the whole thing about Project Runway is there's enough stress, there's enough tension, there's enough anxiety. There's just enough stuff without manufacturing anything. So I see my role as being one of extinguishing it. Get rid of it. Yeah, just get rid of it. And for me, the designers don't do their best work when they're stressed. So let's get rid of everything that doesn't have to be there.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. Anyway, shut up, Tim.
No, bravo.
Hello.
Hi.
So I'm a high school student, and my dream is to be a designer. And so I was wondering what advice you have for high schoolers who are interested in design.
Be a curious sponge. Soak everything up around you. Remember, what's so important to know is that as a designer in any discipline, this is going to sound grand, and it is grand. You are a barometric gauge of your society and culture. Because good design happens in a context. It's societal, it's cultural, it's historic, it's economic, and it's political, which is why design always changes. I'm always saying about fashion in particular, or clothing in particular, we want fashion, but we don't need it. We need clothes. And clothes don't have to change. And I have the greatest respect for the L.L. Bean catalog. I own a lot of L.L. Bean products. But you know, they don't change. And we can rely upon them. That I put in the category of clothing, but fashion has to change. And it's very hard to be a good designer. It's just hard. So have curiosity that's insatiable, just be tenacious about what it is you want to do, and be a weeble. If someone knocks you over, bounce right back up.
Yeah.
Okay? Good
Bravo.
Luck.
Bravo. We're going to have one last question, and it's going to be mine.
Oh.
But there's something I have to read because we're also doing radio for this. We're on like 400 different media. Isn't this fantastic?
Good heavens.
A reminder to our listening audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club. Today we're talking with Project Runway co-host Tim Gunn about his life, career, and mentoring. I'm Brad Rosenstein, and you're not. You can also find video of Commonwealth Club programs online at the club's YouTube channel. But the last thing I wanted to ask you is the incredible success that you've had came to you pretty late in life.
Well, I want to slightly amend that by saying when I was at Parsons as an educator, I thought when it comes to design education, it doesn't get any better than this. Or much better. And when I was chair of the fashion program for 7.5 years, I thought, well, this is really the top of the heap. It doesn't get any better than this. So if Project Runway had never happened, I was an extremely happy guy, feeling very fulfilled. So the thought that at 50, I would have this whole new threshold of my life was extraordinary. I mean, just extraordinary.
But what has it meant now coming to you? And do you think it's different than it would have been had it happened if you were 25?
Well, I guess what I would say to that is it didn't.
Right.
You know, I mean, I believe that things happen. Well, I never think about, well, what if, because it didn't happen that way. I wasn't chasing it. I was a consultant at first. My role in the show was in no one's vocabulary. I never dreamed there'd be a second season. Let alone a season 14. I never dreamed I'd be publishing a fourth book or a first book. So for me, there's not a single day I don't thank my lucky stars and say I'm the luckiest guy I know. And whenever I'm asked the question, what's the one thing you haven't done that you really want to do? My response is, I believe it would be unconditional hubris to wish for anything. I have been so lucky that if I wish for something, I should be struck down by lightning. I really should be. Yeah.
Bravo. Thanks to Tim Gunn.
Thank you all so much. Thank you. Thank you very, very much. And Brad, thank you.
Oh, thank
you were
you.
Wonderful.
My pleasure.
How lovely you are. Thank you.